Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello, Matthew.
Hello. And this week, we'll also be hearing from the director and star of Maxine, that's Ty West, Amir Goth. Plus, we'll also be speaking to Kevin Bacon. He's in Maxine as well, but he's actually talking about Beverly Hills Cop Axel F. And me and Jamie will be reviewing those films, as well as ultra-violent action movie Kill. But first, Jamie, have you been watching anything else this week?
I've been sort of flip-flopping between re-watching Elementary, which me and my wife decided we watched it all, you know, finished it ages ago, and we just wanted something comfort watching. We decided a week ago we wanted something to go back to that we'd really enjoyed, that you could kind of put an episode on before bed every night. So I've started rewatching Elementary and done the first season again, absolutely loving it. As I've said many times on Twitter,
you really rate Johnny Lee Miller's take on Sherlock,
don't
you?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I just think he's great. I think he's one of the best Sherlocks. I really do. I love the whole sort of way they twisted it with Watson, you know, being a female and being his kind of sober companion and giving it a modern take. And I just think it's very clever. The cases are fun. The relationship is great. Yeah, it's just really good blast of sort of intelligent entertainment. So we've been flipping between rewatching Elementary, and then I've been rewatching quite a few Australian horror films that I've always loved Australian horror, but it kind of doesn't hold back, and it's quite distressing and grisly a lot of the time. And I have my favourites. I kind of just decided I'd go back and give myself a little season of classic Australian horror films. So I went back and watched Waking Fright, Picnic at Hanging Rock, Long Weekend, Wolf Creek, a few others. And yeah, just love the flavour of it and the terror of the outback, those wide open spaces just kind of hanging over people, inescapable, forbidding. It's fantastic.
And knowing you, I'm guessing you've been watching quite a bit of the football as well, have you?
That's the other thing, Matt. It's absolutely killed my viewing. I say this, I still watched 67 films last month in what month was it last month? I've lost track of it. Was it
June?
Yes. So I still managed to watch 67 movies, but I was on course like halfway through the month. I was on course for doing 100 in a month, and then the Euro started, and my viewing sort of crashed to a halt because I was watching two games every day. So yeah, it's actually hard. We're recording this on a day with no football, which is a killer to not have anything to kind of look forward to tonight. But yeah, so I've been watching all of that as well. What about you? What have you been viewing?
No, well, to be honest, nothing really outside of this. It's just been busy finishing an issue, and yeah. So nothing big to report apart from a bit of football here and there, a bit of England. Obviously, I mean, it kind of felt a bit like a film, that last England game with the sort of 95th minute overhead kick into the goal.
Yeah, it was all very escapes of victory, wasn't it? The overhead kick at the end. But if it was a Hollywood scripted film, you wouldn't have 120 minutes of absolutely terrible football beforehand. No, that's the only difference. I'd at least give you some excitement.
But anyway, now let's get on to this week's new releases. And first up, it's time for something XXX rated.
So, Maxine, your agent tells us you're quite a popular name in adult film and entertainment. Is that correct?
I'm curious, did you always want to be in that line of work?
I always wanted to be famous.
If you need to read off the sides we gave you, just go ahead, all right?
I know the lines.
She turns to the camera and, through her trauma, addresses the lens directly.
So this is Maxine, the third film in a loose trilogy by Ty West that began with X and then jumped back for prequel Pearl. So this film follows on from the events of X and finds Mia Goth's Maxine Minx, now a successful porn star, but she's looking to move into more legitimate filmmaking. We're in LA, it's 1985, and in the background, the Night Stalker murders are also taking place. And before me and Jamie review the film, we're going to hear from writer-director Ty West and star and producer Mia Goth from when online entertainment editor Emily Murray caught up with them earlier this week.
I don't like walking out here with a freaking Night Stalker guy in the loose.
The Night Stalker.
Night Stalker.
Night Stalker.
He's terrorizing Los Angeles.
I can handle myself.
So said every bad girl in Hollywood.
Maxine, I'm the private detective. I had to find you.
I live
My employer is a very powerful man. The past ain't finished with you. It's gonna keep knocking at your door.
I was reading the press notes, and I found it interesting how you said that you play her like a superhero. So I'm just wondering, you know, what do you mean by that?
Well, there's such a fearlessness to Maxine that she's larger than life. She has a fearlessness to her that I've never come across in another character before. And the way that I was able to make sense of it was to kind of give her these superhero-like qualities to try and make sense of it.
Her fearlessness is why I love her. I love the use of Hollywood locations in this film, in particular the house from Psycho. I'm just wondering what it was like shooting there. Was it surreal in any way?
Yeah, it was very surreal. I mean, when Ty was writing the script, he had incorporated that into the story, but we weren't entirely sure if we were going to be able to actually use those locations. So when we finally got the green light and we wound up there, it was just like one of the coolest days I've ever had on set, you know, over the last 10 years. It was very special, and it had a particular vibe to it, very particular energy. There's something in the air, and it had a way of informing those scenes in a way that I hadn't anticipated, which was quite cool.
Yeah, I think that comes across as well as some of the best scenes in the film. I totally get that. I'm just wondering, this is your third, you know, film. How have you found that your relationship to Maxine's maybe changed since you first stepped into her shoes?
Well, when we first started making these movies, we filmed X, and we've shot that in New Zealand at the height of COVID. And we were, you know, very much in our own little bubble out there. And it's interesting because who Maxine was at that time, you know, she kind of had a chip on her shoulder. She had a lot to prove to the world, and she had a lot to prove to herself. I think that her and I have always kind of lived these parallel lives in a way. And it's interesting. I think I was kind of in a similar spot too. And then fast forward 3 years later, and then we're filming the third movie in this trilogy, and so much has happened within that time. And it's just been really cool to see how these, like, my life and hers have aligned, and I've been able to pull a lot from my own experiences for the character.
Are you quite sad then to maybe, you know, say goodbye to it? Like, how do you feel now it's come to an end?
I don't feel sad. I feel incredibly grateful. No one could have foreseen any of this. When I met Ty for the first time, we were just discussing X. I didn't know about playing older Pearl. I didn't know about the prequel, and I certainly didn't know about Maxine, and it's just evolved into something so creatively fulfilling, and I feel like we've explored everything possible in this trilogy, so I just feel grateful and excited to move forward.
Yeah, talking about moving forward, I'm just wondering, you know, what is next for you? I think you're working on Frankenstein right now, which I'm really excited for, so just wondering what you can tease about that, and yeah, what's coming next?
Yeah, it's been amazing. It's everything I wanted it to be and more. I love Guillermo. I love working with him. He's, you know, he's an incredible director. Everyone knows that, but he's also just like such a wonderful person.
Yeah. And maybe more horror in the future. Do you want to move away from that, I guess?
I mean, I want to try everything. It's not that I would, you know, want to leave horror for good, but I just want to continue to test myself and challenge myself and try new things.
What I love about this one is that it's set in Hollywood. So I feel that really allows for some commentary on how women are treated in the industry. And I also love to look at, like, the industry's attitude towards horror. So is part of the reason why you set it in Hollywood to sort of allow you to weave in, you know, that commentary?
A little bit. I mean, mostly it was the natural progression of where the story could go. I mean, she left X in the 70s and went to, we didn't know where she would go at the end of that movie. And so I felt like she would be going to where, you know, she could become the person she wanted to be. But the absurdity of the place that she ended up in, I've always been sort of amused by the sort of, in many ways, Hollywood is the most glamorous place in the world. And then also there's sort of a seedy underbelly side to it. And I think that also works for what it's like being in Hollywood, not just like the location itself and the place in the city itself, but what it feels like to be a part of it. Is like some days it's amazing, and some days it's putting you on a pedestal in the way that you want to be seen, and then other days it's like breaking you down. And that's sort of the weird nature of show business.
Yeah, and it is very much about show business. I love how there's so many Hollywood landmarks, you know, we have mm-hmm. the sign, but also the house from Psycho, which we see in the trailer. Yeah. Was that always something you wanted to feature, that Psycho house? Because it is such a, it's iconic, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I had mentioned it in X. They had had a conversation about Psycho, and because that movie sort of loomed over X because of that, and just the series in general, because it's one of the all-time great horror movies, and specifically, I guess you could call it a slasher movie. You know, I thought when she made it to Hollywood, she made to a back lot, I was like, well, where could she go? What could they see that would represent you know, movies and horror movies in a certain way? And I thought, oh, well, maybe we could just go there. So I wrote it into the script, not knowing if we would be able to get permission. But thankfully, you know, the Hitchcock Estate gave us the okay, and we got to do it. So it was very surreal to get to film there.
Yeah, it must be strange actually stepping onto that set, right?
It's both strange, and then it's also just to photograph it is very, like, to look at it through the camera, but not be making that movie is very weird. You know, it's like, when would that ever opportunity ever come up? And the answer is like, never, other than this movie.
Yeah, it's an incredible scene. You've spoken before about how these films are sort of made, not made, but it appeals to people who maybe are on the fence about horror. You know, they are horror films, but they're also so much fun, they're action, they're funny. So how do you feel about the fact that these films like Maxine might actually be people's introduction, you know, to the horror genre?
If that were to work out, that's great. I mean, I don't think too much about it in making them. I think the thing about horror is that it can encapsulate all different types of movies. You know, I think some people think of horror and they just think of people getting killed in really gory sequences and they're kind of put off by that. But if for people who say, like, oh, I don't watch horror movies, if you mention to them The Shining or The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby, they say, well, no, that's different. Those are different. But really, it just means that, like, you could do all types of things in horror movies. And so the thing about this trilogy is each movie is very different than the other, and the through line certainly is the character, but it's also thematics. And then the main through line for me as the filmmaker is, like, cinema in general. Mm-hmm. And so these movies very much are how cinema of a certain era is affecting the characters and also affecting the sort of the style of the film. And that, to me, I think you don't have to be a horror fan to like that. I think you just have to like movies.
And it is interesting, the attitude towards horror still today. I think Mia Goth is just an incredible actress. And there's a lot of talk at the moment about how horror movies just aren't recognised, you know, by awards bodies like the Oscars. Like Mia Goth, like for instance in Pearl, with that monologue, I think, you know, proves that the point's wrong. What do you make of the argument that they should consider horror movies more for awards?
You know, I think that kind of depends on how much you awards mean to you. I mean, I think it's a subjective thing that, you know, one award might mean something to somebody and it might not mean something else. Someone might have like the Oscars might be very important to one group of filmmakers and then the Palme d'Or might be very important, or, you know, no awards might be. So it's hard to really kind of encapsulate what any of that really means because it's different for everybody. As someone who makes horror movies and as someone who made the movie that you were very high on the performance from, and having been close to Mia for nearly 5 years now, I would be happy if she was recognized, which she has been. So whether or not she's recognized by a certain organization here or there is, of course, it's always nice to be liked by everybody. But it's okay when you know, people in general are enthusiastic about the work that you're doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mia Goth, I think, said some interesting stuff about Maxine. I like the line that she says in the press notes about how she approached it as if she was playing a superhero. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what that means to you, I guess.
Well, a big part of the third movie is because the first two movies are very contained and they're very different stories than this is. And this was meant to be a big sort of swan song of the series in a way. And so I think, you know, taking her off of these isolated stories and these sort of smaller, more personal stories and bringing her into a broad ensemble in which, you know, she's finally about to make it and she could have that taken away from her. You know, I think we just approached this movie as it's stylistically very different. So, you know, it was really meant to be, I wouldn't call it like a victory lap per se, but it was meant to just be a fun conclusion to this trilogy that we never anticipated making. And I think in that regard, I think she plays a confident, larger than life, able to handle herself kind of person. And so while she faces a lot of threats in this movie, she's a threat herself.
Yeah, and as you say, she's part of a larger ensemble now.
Yeah.
Like, we've got Kevin Bacon, Elizabeth Debicki. I really loved her filmmaker character, Liz. I thought she was just great.
Yeah.
I found it interesting because Elizabeth said that actually it reminds her a little bit of you, the filmmaker character. I'm just wondering what your reaction to that is.
I don't know. We'd have to chat more about it. But, you know, anytime you're a writer and director of a movie and there's a writer or a director in the movie, you are certainly, like, doomed for the obvious parallels for that. I'm sure there are some. You know, when I write it, I don't think of it that way. I'm trying to hopefully bring people behind the curtain a little bit to see what it's like to be a filmmaker and to see that maybe you have these sort of ambitions for what you're doing, but maybe you're also aware that what you're doing is thought of in a certain way and you're trying to make your best in that kind of hypocritical landscape a little bit. And so I'm sure Elizabeth's probably right, and some of the more preposterous natures of the character probably relate to me more than I'd like.
I love the idea of the movie The Puritan too. Mm-hmm. I just want to see it myself. Did you have a picture of maybe what that would look like, you know, when writing Maxine's script?
Well, yeah, I mean, in trying to figure out the movies that Liz had made, I mean, The Puritan is this sort of like 1600s kind of witch trial type movie, and that's what they made that kind of made her popular, a very kind of folk horror type thing. And then The Puritan 2 was going to be something along the lines of like a Stepford Wives kind of housewife type thing that's haunted by the past and such like that. And so they were things that were thematically related to the X stories, but also things that were thematically related to like the kind of puritanical nature and the moral majority aspect of what was going on in the 80s against, you know, certain kinds of art.
We haven't even spoke about the blood and gore. Is it quite satisfying? I guess sort of creating these quite fun but imaginative and bloody, yeah, scenes.
Sometimes. I mean, this movie in particular was meant to be a big kind of audience friendly theatrical experience. So in doing so, I did want all the violence in the movie to be larger than life and to be, you know, satisfying in that sort of applause breaky kind of way. Yeah. So people that are threats to Maxine, you know, when they get their comeuppance, I was really adamant about making it memorable.
Yeah, it's cathartic.
Yeah, exactly.
This is, you know, rounding off a trilogy, but I'm just wondering what's next for you. I know you spoke a bit about maybe a fourth movie, but do you want to maybe try something new first? Or yeah, what's next?
It's hard to say. I mean, I've been doing this for 4.5 years now, pretty much nonstop, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. So I'm a little ready for a break because, you know, in about 2 weeks, it'll be the first day that I wake up and don't have some responsibility related to this X universe. So I'll have a clearer sense probably in the middle of July on what I want to do next. I have some ideas, but you never know what's going to happen until, you know, the snowball starts rolling.
So that was Ty West and Mia Goth on Maxine. Jamie, do you want to take the lead on this one for us?
Yeah, so like you said, Matt, it's set after X, which I thought was a wonderful film, slasher movie set in, this is X, was set in 1979 and was about a group of kind of wannabe DIY porn filmmakers who hired a kind of shack on a farm in 1979 in Texas to shoot a homemade porn movie. And then they were kind of killed one by one. And the only survivor was Maxine Minx, who was just starting out in porn at that time. So that was 1979. This film jumps to 1985. And like you said, she's now a successful porn actress who, you know, is well renowned within the industry. But she wants more. She wants to get into legitimate movies, as it were. And of course, the best way to get into legitimate films, as we know from many young actors who started off this way, was horror movies. You know, this is true of so many people like Tom Hanks, Holly Hunter, Kevin Bacon. There's a whole load of them who starred in 80s horror movies and then went on from there. So she's got her eyes on getting the lead role in a film called The Puritan 2. The Puritan was a kind of indie movie that was a big success, directed by Elizabeth Bender, who's played by Elizabeth Debicki, who is a kind of horror director. She says, I make B-movies with A ideas, and she likes to kind of smuggle important themes into these exploitation movies. So she's making Puritan 2. Maxine is up for an audition to try and get the lead. So that's one kind of plot strand in this, her trying to break into Hollywood. Then, like you also said, in the background, you've got the Night Stalker killings happening, which really did happen in 80s LA. Richard Ramirez, there's a fantastic documentary, actually, The Night Stalker, The Hunt for a Serial Killer, which was on Netflix a couple of years ago. So if you want to know more about a Night Stalker, really terrifying figure. And he kind of held all of LA, you know, in his grasp, so that everyone was terrified while these killings and sexual assaults happened. So this is going on in the background, and various people Maxine kind of rub shoulders with kind of fall foul to the Night Stalker, or kind of, you know, enter his world in a way. So that is also going on. So there's a few things happening, and various other characters come in. Ty West, the writer director, has actually described it as his kind of Robert Altman movie, that there's 30 speaking roles, like big speaking roles, who kind of crisscross in this movie, and it's set all over LA. You see the glamorous side of LA, you see the sort of sleazy side. So it's a big kind of 80s style thriller.
And did you actually like this film, Jamie, as well?
I really enjoyed it. It's one of those movies. I don't think it's a great movie. Like, I don't think it's as good as X, and I don't think it's as interesting as Pearl, that did. That was set in 1918. It was a prequel and sort of resurrected golden age Hollywood, that it was playing with movies like Wizard of Oz and Mary Poppins and sort of doing this horror film in that kind of heightened fantastical world. And it was really interesting. I don't think this film is as interesting as that, but it's just purely entertaining. Mm. It's like I said, it's like an 80s thriller. It's set in 1985 and it's got all the music from the era, and it's quite glossy and slick looking. And it's the kind of big scale film noir with loads of twists and turns. And just as a movie to go to on a Friday night and have a few scares and have lots of excitement and chases and things like that, I think it really works. It's just highly, highly entertaining. But like I said, I maybe wouldn't put it quite as high as the first two.
I feel very similar to you, although maybe a tiny bit cooler than you. Just in that, like, I think the first two sort of benefited from the element of surprise a bit more, didn't they? In that X kind of felt like it came out of nowhere. And then Pearl, they shot that almost on the quiet. And so it was suddenly was ready to come out in a very short space of time after X. Like, it came out about 6 months later, I believe.
Yeah.
And so then Maxine then comes with expectations that the other two didn't have. So already it's got its work cut out more than those films did have. But I felt similar to you in that I really enjoyed it in the sense of it was fun, over the top, in the right places. I really enjoyed the world it created and that kind of grimy 80s world. And like you mentioned, the Night Stalker, but then we're also getting real kind of news footage cut in, and it ties into the sort of satanic panic of the era as well. So I just enjoy revisiting all that. I'm also, as I always say this, but I'm a real sucker for like films about filmmaking and anything where we're going a bit behind the scenes or going into Hollywood, you know, going onto sets. I automatically am just going to enjoy that. So that's very much in my wheelhouse and the kind of thing I like. So I'm, again, predisposed to like that sort of thing. Mia Goth is really good in all these films, and she's like really good here as well. She's sort of producing as well as starring, but she really kind of powers it along. But then I sort of just couldn't help feeling it was just slightly lacking something. I just wanted a bit more sort of oomph or punch from, you know, some of the reveals we got. Or I just wondered if it was going to go somewhere with a bit more depth to it, maybe. I don't know. And even just be kind of brutal, something a bit more interesting. It just felt like it just went from one bit to the next, if you know what I mean. And I didn't always feel like I understood the character motivations. Not that you take a film like this, you know, super seriously in that sense, but there were even times where things were happening and I wasn't quite sure what, you know, why. And there, like, as you mentioned, there are all these characters, and I sometimes wish they could have just focused it a bit more tightly, maybe. Some of them just feel that they just don't really make much impact at all to me. And even, I'd even go as far as to say Elizabeth Debicki, whose character I was really looking forward to and has some sort of fun moments. I just wanted a bit more of that almost. So I feel like I just would have liked it to have maybe focused on a couple of the supporting characters and given them a bit more time to breathe, like her director, for example.
You have got, I mean, Elizabeth Debicki, I agree. I wish she was in it more, because she plays, I mean, obviously you didn't get many female horror directors in the 1980s. The big two famous ones were Mary Lambert, who did Pet Sematary, and Catherine Bigelow, who did Near Dark. And then there was a couple of other sort of smaller ones who did stuff like Slumber Party Massacre. But, you know, it was very, very rare. It's a very patriarchal industry, and especially in horror movies. So I liked her portraying a woman in that time and being really sort of ballsy and tough to make an impact. And she based the character very much on those female directors I just mentioned, even in the way she dresses and stuff, but she kind of took them as an inspiration. So I found that really interesting and exciting. But like you say, she's not in it a great deal because you have so many characters. You've got like Kevin Bacon playing a sleazy PI who kind of hunts down Maxine. He's got a client, a kind of mystery client. He's kind of obsessed with Maxine, so he hires this PI to hunt her down. And that's one of the big reveals, like who the client is in the final act. And I found that a bit underwhelming, that the whole movie you're sort of building up to why, who is this person and why is he obsessed with Maxine? And when you find out, even though it ties into various themes of the trilogy, so it's quite clever in that way, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give anything away, but it still felt a little bit underpowered. But what I do love about this whole trilogy as a whole, and I think this is so clever, it's just how much little echoes and patterns and overlap there is. It's so kind of all the connective tissue, little kind of callbacks. And like, for example, there's a scene in this one, which you've seen glimpse in the trailer, but the famous Psycho House on the Universal lot, you know, the Bates house behind the Bates Motel, plays a part in this film. And that sort of goes back. There's a conversation in X about Psycho. And of course, Psycho was the granddaddy of all the slasher movies. It kind of started it in a way. So that ties in with this being a trilogy of slasher movies. And even stuff like Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, you know, if you actually do a bit of research to him, he was a Texan. So he lived in LA and he sort of did his spree of terror kind of on the West Coast. But he was born and grew up in Texas, which again ties in with the first two movies that they're set in Texas on the farm. And there's so many things like that, so many little Easter eggs. I really think that in years to come, you know, you could kind of study this trilogy on a course. And Ty West has really worked it out very cleverly and very intricately. So all of that, I love that side of it. I thought that was great.
And tying into that as well, how far do you think someone could enjoy this if they hadn't seen the previous two films? Would you suggest they catch up before they go to the cinema, or do you think you can just dive in on this one?
I think you can totally dive in. It works as a standalone. I mean, if you've seen X, like not so much Pearl, I don't, that's almost kind of separate, even though it's kind of connected. But X, you'd obviously get an earlier version of Maxine and her starting out, and you'd get why she's so traumatized and why she's become the person she has, because the way she has responded to the trauma of X and being a lone survivor of this massacre is she's gone out and just thought, I'm going to be tough and I'm going to have what the hell I want out of life and I'm going to go after it and no one's going to stand in my way. So you kind of maybe get a bit more of that, why in this film she's so kind of ballsy and gutsy. But it's not essential. You know, I think if you just wandered in with some friends on a Friday night and sat down and thought, oh, this looks good, I'll watch this Maxine movie, and you don't even know it's part of a trilogy, you'll be absolutely fine. It stands on its own legs.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. So if you do fancy giving that a go, that is Maxine, which is in cinemas from Friday the 5th of July. And next up, we're sticking with the 80s theme with a different kind of throwback film.
James.
Hey, this is your father.
Before you hang up, I'm in town.
I've been arrested. Hello?
You sure y'all paying y'all's bills? Because this phone don't work.
This isn't my first time in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, I saw that. 84, 87, and then 94. But this place has changed a bit.
What brings you back to 90210? I got a call from Billy.
He's in trouble now.
What do you want from me?
I want you to be a cop again.
You gotta do something.
Axel, if you damage any city property...
You're in a snowplow?
Yeah, we're in a damn snowplow. What's the problem?
This is Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, which is the fourth film in the action comedy series starring Eddie Murphy, who reprises his role here. We're in the present day, and Axel ends up being drawn back to Beverly Hills when his lawyer daughter Jane, played by Taylor Page, runs into trouble on a case she's working on. There are many familiar faces here, but one new character is played by another icon of the 80s, Kevin Bacon. He's playing Beverly Hills Police Captain Cade Grant, and we're going to hear from him now. This is when he recently spoke to senior online writer Lauren Malisi.
Y'all safe? Everybody safe?
There's no seatbelt in the middle.
The hell with the seatbelt? We on the edge!
I need some backup.
Whoa! What are you doing?
I'm getting us some backup.
God, I missed you, Axel.
Were you a fan of the franchise before signing on for Beverly Hills Cop 4?
Absolutely. Yeah. They're just fun movies. Eddie is infectiously charming and funny and dynamic and reluctantly heroic and all the things. I mean, he was just great in those movies. And I think the combination of action and comedy, and it's the great fish out of water franchise, you know? And so, yeah, I was thrilled when I got the call.
I feel like you don't always play a villain. Can you talk a little bit about that? Are we going to see more of a villain era from you?
I don't go out specifically and look for villains. I've never been someone who's afraid of doing bad things in movies because people are going to think bad things about me. You know, I think there are actors who are like, oh, I don't want to do that because that's not going to look good for who I want to be in the public persona. But I don't really care about that. I might be able to kind of separate those two things in my life. And so when you open that door, that means that, you know, you're going to get some opportunities to play people that do morally or, you know, reprehensible things. And I have no problem with it. To me, it's not so much about whether or not I'm playing a villain. It's more about is it a complex part? Is it an interesting part? And is it, you know, different from something that I've done before? And do I have a hook into how to walk in this man's shoes.
You've been picking a lot of different like genre projects lately, like from They/Them to Toxic Avenger. Can you talk about kind of at this stage in your career, kind of how you're picking your projects?
You know, the same way that I always have, you know, send me the script. I'll take a look at the elements, look if there's something fun for me to do in it. I don't think about the genre. I don't think about the budget of the movie. I don't think about the size of the part. I think about, you know, if it's good. And if I can find a hook and I mean, listen, I'd love to act, and to get the opportunity to be able to keep doing it after so many years is I'm incredibly grateful for it, because the time between action and cut, like that's my sweet spot.
Can you talk a little bit about working with Eddie Murphy? Was it your first time ever working with him?
My first time working with Eddie, it was great. He's a very relaxed and focused and immediate sort of actor. You know what I mean? He's got a great, honest simplicity to the way that he approaches the scenes that is almost, it's disarming, you know? It's like I had to kind of stay on my toes, because he would just kind of look at me and just maybe throw something out there that I wasn't even expecting. And it was great. I loved it. I loved our scenes together. And I think they really work really well in the movie. So I'm very proud of that.
So that was Kevin Bacon on Beverly Hills Cop Axel F. Jamie, do you want to set this one up a bit further for us?
So it's pretty much as you say, because there's not a great deal of plot to it. It's quite streamlined, that all it is Axel Foley is now a bit older and a bit wiser. He's still based in Detroit. He's still got his motor mouth. And obviously with these movies, he always ends up having to go to Beverly Hills, hence the title. And the reason he goes this time is that his estranged daughter, Jane, is a defense lawyer, and she is defending a guy who she feels has been framed for murder. And she feels the real culprit is a cop, and that there are some corrupt cops who are perhaps working for Captain Grant, Kevin Bacon, because he's a bit sleazy and he's got a Rolex watch. It's like, how did he afford that? So she's kind of digging into that, and she has her life threatened early on in the film. It's kind of, leave this case alone or you're going to get it. And obviously Axel, even though he's estranged from her, he loves her very much. He wants to make up with her. He goes to Beverly Hills. And he kind of wants to protect her and dig into the case to help her solve it. So that's the reason he's there. Apart from that, it's quite a streamlined plot. It's very 80s thriller in a way, like the original film, in that it's just kind of corrupt cops. There's a bit of drug cartel action in there. You know, it's kind of just a run and gun mission, really. We've got used maybe in the last few years to films that are always bigger scale. You know, it's always universe saving and stuff like that. So I really enjoyed the fact that it went back to kind of 80s, 90s action thrillers, where it's just not too big a plot. The stakes aren't too high. They're a bit more personal. And then it's just kind of, you know, action, vehicular mayhem. The thing I particularly liked about this film is nearly all of the action is done in camera, like it used to be, you know, in the first Beverly Hills Cop movies. And there's all sorts of vehicles, you know, be it cars or golf carts or helicopter, you know, there's loads of vehicles and lots of sort of crunchy in-camera action where you really feel the prangs. And yeah, I enjoyed this movie. I didn't expect to, because I thought Beverly Hills Cop 3 was a bit of a mess. That was 1994. It's obviously been like 30 years since that movie. And you always wonder, why are they coming back? Like Coming to America, the other Eddie Murphy recent kind of a belated sequel, was so disappointing. And I kind of thought, can they recapture the magic in this one? And is it a cynical exercise? But I actually thought it was really enjoyable for what it is. I'm not making any great claims for it. You know, it's probably a high 3-star movie, but it's on Netflix. And if you want to just watch a film on Netflix on Friday night and have a bit of nostalgia and a few callbacks and some good in-camera action and Eddie Murphy kind of actually caring maybe for the first time in a few years and putting in a performance. I enjoyed it. It's good.
That makes me feel terribly old to think that the third one is now 30 years old. Again, I'm coming from a sort of similar place to you, really, in that, yeah, I wasn't really a big fan of Coming to America. I thought it was just about Passport. But these legacy sequels can be a real mixed bag, because you have Top Gun Maverick as the absolute high watermark. And obviously, we've had some other great ones as well, like Blade Runner 2049, for example. Brilliant. But they can go wrong. So I approached this with trepidation as well. And I was pleasantly surprised as well like you say, for those sort of throwback elements, easy to watch. Eddie Murphy was actually back on form again, I thought, again, in comparison to, he's had a couple of decent, like, or semi-serious roles, like My Name is Dolomite and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, in comparison to Coming to America, he felt more on form here than there. And it was nice having him back. There were some funny moments. And I actually thought that the chemistry between him and Taylor Page as his daughter, I thought that worked well and added something to the story. And also in that mix, having Joseph Gordon-Levitt as another cop who is his daughter's ex as well, I thought that dynamic played out nicely. But This is firmly in the throwback legacy sequel mold, where it doesn't really try to do anything particularly differently. It sticks very much to the formula, and it brings back basically every recognizable face you could possibly hope to see in it, so for better or worse. So I thought it was fine. I feel like it sort of benefits in a way from the fact that it's just going straight to Netflix. I feel like if it was getting a big cinema rollout, maybe I'd come at it with higher expectations and hope for a bit more. And I mean, it's never going to live up to Top Gun, even though I feel like the title's trying to ape that a bit, where you had Top Gun colon Maverick, and here you've got Beverly Hills Cop colon Axel F. But it was never going to live up to that. And I mean, few films can, really, whether they're legacy sequels or not. If it had almost more of a build up to it like that, maybe it would have raised my expectations a bit too much and I'd have then felt disappointed. But coming at it without massive expectations, it was, you know, it was very enjoyable and easy to watch, and a very, very easy thing to throw on a Friday night, you know, when you're looking at your streaming options, I think.
Yeah, I agree that the relationship with his daughter was good. You know, I thought that added something. And Eddie Murphy has actually said that the reason they've taken so long to do a fourth installment is because they were going to make one after the third installment. And every time they came up with a new script, it's just the same again. It's like, I'm going to Beverly Hills, I'm on a mission. What's the point? And it wasn't till now that he's kind of older, he's near retirement age, all of the people he knows from the first movies are kind of beginning to think or have retired, and he's got an estranged daughter. All of this kind of added new elements to it, so he thought, oh, okay, there's something here. I thought that dynamic was done very well. And also that whole thing, because it's set all these years later, they've always been fish out of water movies, a Detroit cop in LA, but now you've got the thing of the era change as well, that Joseph Gordon-Levitt's cop, who you mentioned, he's obviously, you know, far more kind of modern man and reasonable and, you know, and intelligent in a way. And then you've got Eddie Murphy coming in, and he's like trying to sort of give it a bit of sort of toxic BS, and all of this, and the way he tries to deal with cases just doesn't fly anymore. You know, there's one line where they say, oh, you know, cops now are social workers, you know, things have changed. So, and it's quite clever that obviously in the first three movies you always had Axel Foley go into situations and he'd use his mouth to kind of get what he wanted. So he'd go in and he'd like do his big voice and he'd sort of pretend to be someone he wasn't, and he'd get into a place he shouldn't be allowed. And in this film, they kind of flip it on its head a bit, that a few times he goes in and gives it all of his guff, and then it doesn't work because times have changed and people are just looking at him going, what are you going on about? And it's his daughter, who's very sensible and controlled and more sensitive, who then comes in and has a few quiet words, and then maybe they get into the place. So I thought that was quite clever. And you also mentioned Top Gun Maverick, and the thing it takes from that film is just that this character now is a bit older and wiser, like Maverick was. You've still got the cockiness, and you've still got the wise mouth and the wise cracking and the swearing and all of that that you expect from Axel F, but you've also got just a little bit of kind of wisdom and melancholy around the edges, that, you know, he's getting on a bit, he's now in his 50s. So I thought that was quite nicely done. So like I said, you know, I'm not saying it's fantastic, but I think as a legacy sequel, all these years later, it does a very decent job.
And so if you fancy that, that is Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, which is on Netflix now. And now for the final film of the week, it's time to board a full-on action thriller.
Welcome. Please prepare for departure. We hope you have a safe, pleasant, and delightful journey ahead. Thank you.
So this is Kill, which is an Indian action film written and directed by Nikhil Nagesh Bhatt. And you can sum it up quite simply, really. There's not a huge deal of plot to go into. But basically, at the core of the story is this army commando, Amrit, played by Lakshya. And him and his mate Viresh, Abhishek Chauhan, they sort of find themselves on this train where Amrit is going, following his love, Tulika, who's played by Tanya Maniktala. And she's engaged to someone else. He's of lower status than her, but he's kind of following her on this train, hoping to sort of win her family over. But also on this train is a massive 40-strong gang of villains, basically. And it quickly turns violent on the train. And we find yourself in one of the situations where often we would call it a one-man army situation. It's a nice little sort of twist here that it's kind of a two-man army situation where Amrit is the lead character, but Viresh is quite a key character too. And from then, events just escalate on this speeding train. And there's just lots of close quarters violence, basically, as Amrit's trying to, you know, trying to connect with his love and look after her, and then also, you know, stop these bad guys. And it goes from there, basically. And it's just one of those, it's kind of sold as like the most violent Indian film ever made, obviously. I mean, I don't know quite how you quantify that, but it's in that John Wick non-stop kind of mold. And that's it, basically. That's how it starts. There's not really much more I can say about the plot, I don't think. Have I missed any crucial plot information there, would you say?
No, I don't think so, apart from the fact that, you know, Amrit and Tulika are childhood sweethearts, that they're very much in love, and her father has kind of arranged this marriage to a more wealthy man. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not like he's being creepy that he's on the train following her. And, you know, he's very much, they love each other and they want to be together. And then, like you said, it's this army of sort of bandits on the train. It's 40 of them, and they're just going to rob everyone on the train of their jewelry and their money. And what they didn't kind of figure on was having these two highly trained commandos in the midst who decide they're not going to take it and they're going to fight back.
So it's pretty straightforward stuff. I kind of liked this in a way that you can't go too far wrong with a pure action film a lot of the time, I think. But to me, I found it a little bit cheesy, especially to begin with. And I must admit, I found Lakshya, if that's how you pronounce his name, a bit bland as a leading man. He very much looks the part, kind of handsome, muscular, stoic. But I didn't find him the most charismatic presence. That was a bit of a, you know, a drawback for me. And I found that it got somewhat samey over time, in that it's just all this close quarters violent fighting, basically a lot of, you know, knives and blades over gunplay really here. And it's, you know, done well enough. I wouldn't say it's quite got the intensity of things like John Wick or The Raid, for example. Doesn't yeah. quite reach that bar, but, you know, it was entertaining enough in that non-stop breathless kind of way. How did you find it, Jamie?
Kind of the same, that it's got some very good reviews and people have got very excited by it, and I enjoyed it. I love movies set on a train for a start. I'm a sucker for a train journey, be it Lady Vanishes, Hitchcock, Trains to Busan. I've always enjoyed movies set on a train where, you know, you're kind of in the carriages and things are happening, and every now and then you cut to a exterior shot of a train hurtling through the night, rattling along. You know, I've always enjoyed that. And you've got this whole action movie set on a train, so it's all confined spaces, you know, all the fights, martial arts. You know, it reminded me of a scene in Kill Bill 2 in the trailer with L Driver, you know, that obviously it's such confined space that things are always getting in the way and elbows are hitting bunk beds and stuff like that. But like you said, it does get a bit samey, that when you've got almost 2 hours of that, even though the action is pretty well choreographed, I think it over relies on cutting. It kind of annoyed me a bit that it's one of those action movies where sometimes you just want to watch the martial arts, but it gets a lot of its impact from cut, 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 cut. So that was a bit too much for me, but it is well done, although it's nowhere near the level of the Raid movies or the best John Wick movies. What surprised me about it is how sadistic it is. You know, like you said, they've marketed it almost as the most gruesome, violent Hindi language film there's ever been. And there is a lot of hammers, there's knives, there's bars, there's fire extinguishers, pummeling faces, there's a face on fire. And it's one of those movies where you really feel it. So when someone puts a blade into you, you know, the foley is fantastic and you really hear the sort of squelch and then pulling the blade back out, you know, it's really it reminded me of the Scream movies, that it really kind of hurts every time someone is stabbed. And it's also one of those action movies that it wants its cake and eat it, but even though it's non-stop martial arts and violence, it's hoping to kind of be a bit emotional and make you care for the characters in the way, you know, Train to Busan tried to do that. And it kind of semi-succeeds in that I did feel, you know, a little bit of grief when some of these characters meet their demise in very nasty ways. And there's a few shock kills, you know, no one is safe, women, children, you know, there's some really nasty deaths that you don't expect, and you do kind of mourn these people, even though, like you say, it's a little bit cheesy at times. But overall, I thought it was good. I don't quite understand why it's getting some of the rave reviews it's getting. I think, you know, like the other two movies we've reviewed this week, for me, it's a kind of three-star movie, high three stars if you're being generous. I'd recommend it. I think you'll have a good time with it at the cinema. You'll enjoy it. But it's not something I'd say you have to see. You know, I really get behind this one. It's just a sort of good, entertaining movie.
Yeah, I feel very similar. One very random thing which I actually did like that I was going to mention as well was I like the fact that the title card just comes up really random, or not randomly, but the title card suddenly comes up like about 45 minutes in.
Yeah.
And I sort of like that. And it feels like it means business when that comes up, but not like it hasn't been quite killy before then. But
yeah,
it's like something snaps, you know, and you kind of know what you're in for when that comes up. So I thought that was just a small flourish that I liked.
We should probably also say that even though we both found this movie a bit repetitive, you kind of expect that from a movie called Kill, don't you? Yeah. I mean, it's kind of what it says on the tin, that it is just a movie where it kill, 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 kill all through it. And there's a line near the end where one of the bandits kind of says to our hero, he says, like, you know, I've killed four of your men, you've killed 40 of my family, you know, like, what are you? And it is, you know, that's how many people are getting killed that we're talking about. But it is kind of pretty relentless. And we should probably also say that it's being remade, isn't it, in America, that Chad Stahelski, who did the John Wick movies, is apparently kind of very interested in doing an English language adaptation of it. So it'd be interesting how that works out.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all, either that they're remaking it or that he would be interested. But if you fancy catching this version, that is Kill, which is in cinemas from Friday the 5th of July. Now, what is your film of the week this week, Jamie?
It's a really difficult one because, like I just said, none of the three films I absolutely adore and say you have to see this movie. All of the three I really enjoyed, and I'd give them similar star ratings, kind of 3.5 maybe out of 5. If I had to name one, I'm probably going to go with Maxine just over Beverly Hills Cop. But I think it is just a very slick, entertaining, fun movie that would be a good Friday night at the cinema.
Yeah, again, I just keep copying you today, but I feel very similarly because, yeah, there's not a great deal in them. But for me, picking a film of the week, it would be between Maxine and Beverly Hills Cop, Axel F. And Maxine just sneaks it for me, just because it just felt a bit more interesting, a bit more fresh, I suppose, compared to the comforting familiarity of Beverly Hills Cop. But with the genres in mind, I just don't think you can go too far wrong with any of these films this week, to be honest. You won't be blown away by any of them, but I think they're all, you know, enjoyable in their own right, have enjoyable elements. And I don't feel any of them you'll feel you've wasted your time if you bother to either seek them out at the cinema or turn on Netflix for Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah, fully agree. The other thing Maxine has over the others is Mia Goth, who I think is really, really talented and kind of a modern day scream queen. That she's in Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein that he's shooting at the moment. And obviously she was in Infinity Pool. She's done a few horror movies and she's just a really engaging, intense actress that has a very sort of likable quality, but also goes very deep and you kind of feel the pain and the trauma. I think she's great.
Agreed. So that's Maxine, film of the week just there. And we're approaching the end of the podcast now, but just a reminder that our Deadpool and Wolverine issue is out now, so you can find it in shops or pick it up digitally. And if you take out a subscription, you will get instant digital access to that issue, because now you have access to a big digital archive of back issues, including the current one, so you can get reading that straight away before your first print copy arrives. So if you don't subscribe already, please do consider signing up. And we'll leave a subscription link in the podcast notes if you fancy checking that out. And talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, please do subscribe and review on your podcast app of choice. And remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. We do always like to hear from you. But before we go, just time for a quick question based on Maxine. What is your favorite 80s horror, Jamie?
Oh my God, man.
I'm gonna go first because you're gonna have like a bigger pool to draw from than I am.
I was gonna say, do you want my short answer or long answer? But you go first.
But the obvious one for me would have to be A Nightmare on Elm Street, I think, just simply because it was one of those films where Freddy Krueger would be my favorite of those slasher icons anyway, I suppose. But I was so scared of just the idea of it before I ever saw it. And, you know, the kind of the art on the VHS. And I had a slightly older cousin who had this massive like Freddy Krueger poster on his wall. And I was like so scared of the poster. I used to just hate going around his house because it just was this massive kind of close up of Robert Englund's face and the, you know, the glove. And so I was just so scared of even sort of being there that it just had all those associations and all that built up dread before I even got to see it. And then I just think it's just such a great idea. And then the idea of something like haunting your dreams like that is just the ultimate thing to carry over after you've seen the film, and then kind of, you know, fear going to bed and fear going to sleep afterwards. So that's my pick. So what are you going for, Jamie?
Well, you've copied me a few times today. I'm going to copy you in saying that I'm not going for Nightmare on Elm Street, but like you, it was my gateway drug into horror movies. That when I was sort of a teenager or maybe even a bit younger, I watched it with a friend and it absolutely screwed me up. But at the same time, I adored it and couldn't get enough. And I had a big Freddy Krueger poster on my wall and a Pinhead poster and various others. So the first Elm Street's up there, but it's such a rich era for horror. You've got so many masters working at the top of their game. You've got Cronenberg with Videodrome, The Fly, Dead Ringers. You've got Carpenter with The Thing, Christine, Prince of Darkness, The Fog, Argento with Tenebrae and Inferno, Romero, Day of the Dead, Craven, Nightmare on Elm Street. And then you've got other movies like, obviously, The Shining, Kubrick, absolute classic, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, American Werewolf in London, and Evil Dead 2, two of the greatest kind of comedy horrors. I'm going to throw in, because these are all obvious choices. Anyone who knows the genre will probably have the same titles. But one you may not know for anyone listening that I highly recommend is an Austrian film called Angst, a very sort of tough meat, disturbing, brilliantly made, technically audacious serial killer film based on a true case. You have to buy the Region 1. Unfortunately, it's not available over in the UK, but buy the Region 1. You won't regret it. That's brilliant. But that's my waffly answer going all around the houses. If I had to name one gun to head, I'm going to go The Thing, John Carpenter. Probably just over The Shining. You know, it's definitely, if I'm doing my top 10 horror movies all the time, it's definitely in the top 5, probably top 3. So, yeah, I'll go The Thing.
No other choice. Nice. So that's all from us this week. But thanks very much for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.